Diane?
Yes.
Okay. We're here and we're recording now, I think.
Okay, good.
Okay. Okay, this is Scott, and I've got on the phone Diane Mushill-Hamilton. And for those who may not be familiar with Diane, Diane is, among other things, Genpo Roshi's first successor in the Big Mind process. She's a Dharma holder in traditional Zen, a trained mediator, which I am also. She's taught at Integral Institutes, Integral Life Practice. I guess you've done the Level 1 and Level 2 seminars.
Mm-hmm.
And you've done Integral Zen seminar also, right? Training in that?
Yeah, I still do those currently.
Okay. And lots of other things. I know that you're involved with integrallife.com. Well, obviously just integral, period, and also iEvolve, I think. Is that true?
Yeah, I founded iEvolve with my good friend and partner, Mark Goffney, and Sally Kempton, and also Sophia Diaz. And it was our way of kind of coalescing people in the integral world who wanted to do spiritual practice. So we pulled together people from some different traditions so that we would have kind of a core of practice for people who are integrally informed but also want to do, you know, intensive spiritual practice.
Wonderful, wonderful. And let me go ahead and give the website for anybody who wants to visit. There's iEvolve.org, and then there's DianeMushill-Hamilton.org, and then obviously there's IntegralNaked.org and IntegralLife.com, which contain a lot of different things that Diane's involved with, and you say Rabbi Gaffney and several others, many others actually, all based around integral theory, which I love very much. But the reason that we're talking today is, now for the good stuff, is because I contacted you, Diane, because of your work, your shadow work, stuff that you've been doing, that I've watched some videos and some audios with you, with several people talking about shadow work. And everyone listening probably knows who I am, and the fact that just recently, within the last year or so, I started to talk about shadow work in my own expression because I found it to be so helpful, so very helpful. And I've told Ken, you know, Wilbur, I've just thanked him so much for kind of bringing that issue to light for me. I didn't really know anything about shadows or shadow work, and it was Ken who first brought that to light. And then through my interest in Ken's work is how I came upon the videos and audios that I watched and heard and loved your insight about this, and I've been wanting to actually talk to you about this, so it's really, really, really a pleasure to have you on the phone right now.
Well, thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
So, Diane, so is shadow work something that you, I know you've got 20 years or more in Zen training, is shadow work or shadow process, is that something that you were always interested in, or when did that come about for you?
Well, it really comes up for me from two different places, and the first was in my work as a mediator. When I did that work, I often was in the position of facilitating group dialogues, and I would facilitate dialogues on tough issues like, religious issues or issues related to to gender or to gender relations or just political conversations. And I started to see that in a group setting that there was always a shadow that was kind of underlying the conflict. And until I learned how to actually move towards it and bring it out, usually the thing that didn't want to be said or the unpopular view that was driving the conversation or the value that people didn't want to identify with or whatever it was. And I started to see that until I brought that out and related with it, that we simply couldn't move forward. And so it came up in my life in a really practical way. And then I also, due to the amount of time that I've spent, of course, in training in, you know, Buddhist centers, just seeing how much spiritual practice tends to, we call it, kind of bypass shadow quality. So even though people have spent quite a lot of time on the cushion and have really clarified, even a non-dual realization, there still may be things in their personality structure or in their unconscious consciousness that creeps out and affects how they interact, and which just simply doesn't seem to be able to be addressed. And it's kind of also worth noting, I think, that Carl Jung, who is the, you know, the great psychological pioneer, who really, as I understand it, coined the word shadow, that his book, in which he did a just intensive investigation of his own unconscious, was just published recently, just in the last couple of weeks. So this whole inquiry that he had, it really, really kind of owning and looking very deeply into, you might say, the darker side or the marginalized parts or the unfamiliar or the just very shameful parts of who we are that exist and that kind of leak out, but that we don't tend to take responsibility for.
Right, right. There's so much stuff in what you just said to hit on, so many big points. I wanted, first of all, as an attorney and mediator, I do know what you mean about the shadows that pop up in litigation and mediation. And I wondered your take on this is how open were the people involved in those situations to kind of address some of these shadow issues? Or did you find yourself kind of addressing it through the back door without acknowledging that's what you were doing? Or was there an openness in some situations to deal with some of those things?
The issue, as I saw it, was it depends on the context. In these large group facilitations that I used to do, the group would always be relieved because I was often speaking unspoken qualities. Like, for instance, you talk about a lawsuit in litigation. How often will someone who's trying to settle a lawsuit identify with the voice of greed?
Yeah.
How often will someone identify with the voice of revenge?
Right.
How often will someone identify with the voice? Well, we tend to identify more with voices of powerlessness, that we're being victimized, that we're not being treated fairly, that we're somehow being taken advantage of. But when it comes to the other side of the equation, it's very rare for someone to identify as being the one who is taking advantage of, or the one who is oppressing, or the one who is, you know, aggressive or hostile. Like, for people to actually own that, it's just very, it really is very rare.
It is rare, and at the same time, I think that there's such value not just in spiritual practice, but also just all across the business and law and in all areas of life. If we were to take this on a little bit, there's just freedom on the other side of that, and I think it kind of has to be experienced to be believed or understood. But so I think that it's almost to me like shadow work feels like this untapped resource. It's being tapped into, but it just seems like something that really can help humanity as a whole in ways that I think we haven't completely come to terms with yet.
most of our ways of dealing with shadow are pretty unconscious. Like generally one of the ways that we deal with shadow is we just tend to scapegoat people. So if a group is having a struggle and there are issues in the background, we kind of will pick out one person and let them hold the problem, kind of drive them out of the group, and that kind of takes care of things for a while until it creeps up again. So we have kind of very primitive ways of dealing with shadow that are for the most part unconscious.
Right, right. So let's start, because that's a good start about those kinds of issues, but let's start with just the basics, because I know that when I first started to talk about shadows and shadow work, I had to be very specific in just defining it for people, because had they not read something in that area from some psychologist or from integral theory, they may not have understood. And so I had to kind of just, the best that I could, define it. And I wondered, do you have a definition that you have for people that you can just kind of say, in plain English, this is what kind of a shadow is?
Yeah, a shadow is really any part of our awareness that we're not willing to identify with.
Okay, that's very simple, and I like that, simple. So that's a starting point in a way to kind of understand what shadows are.
And then the
next thing that I had, the two words that I had written down after what is shadow is shadow boxing and shadow hugging. And before we get into that, I did notice that John Wellwood had a definition of, if I can find it here, I just had it earlier today. Well, in any event, if I can find it, I will, but he had a really good definition. If I run across it, I'll explain it again, or I'll say it out loud. But the one that I had written down, it's an aspect of our own story that for whatever reason we repress and we project outward as an other. But at least that's one way that it can manifest. And then, so the next thing I was going to ask you is, before we get into how to spot that or what damage it might cause, those two terms, shadow hugging and shadow boxing, can you kind of speak to those a little bit in your own words?
Well, I have never actually heard shadow hugging before. It's kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so tell me what you understand about it.
Okay, shadow hugging would be sometimes when we idealize or strongly attracted to someone else, not knowing that it's a trait that we've kind of repressed in ourselves. It might be great love, it might be wisdom, okay. It might be attractiveness, but it's something that it's almost so powerful, so beautiful that we don't believe that we could actually have that, and so instead it becomes in another, and we hug the other, we idealize the other.
Okay, in the integral world, we refer to that what you're calling shadow hugging as the golden shadow.
What's it called?
The golden shadow.
Golden shadow. Okay.
Yeah. So basically, in the same way that we have negative qualities like greed, as I mentioned before, or like revenge that we can't identify with. And when I say identify, what I mean is that we can't let it be part of ourselves. You know, that I am not greedy. I am not vengeful. Because we just cut out things from our identity that are either shameful to us or that are make us nervous or whatever it is. But we also do that with positive qualities, right? So as you were saying, it could be the capacity for great love. It could be some kind of, it comes up in spiritual circles quite a bit where spiritual teaching relies on it a little bit, which is that the students project great spiritual authority onto the spiritual teacher. That's a golden shadow because ultimately everybody is their own spiritual authority and everybody has or is, you know, in my tradition we would call it, you know, you not that you have Buddha nature, but you are Buddha nature. You do have awakened, you know, qualities that are innate to who you are. They're not separate from you, but you project those onto the spiritual teacher, and then if the spiritual teacher is a good teacher, they don't hold those for you. They actually give them back to you and help you see it in yourself.
Right. I think that's really important, actually. Well, that was a good example of what I call the shadow hugging, is because in my own spiritual path, I had one or two teachers. One especially, I was doing a lot of shadow hugging and idealizing, and thankfully he did speak to that. Which at the time I didn't have the 3-2-1 process, which we'll talk about. I didn't really have a process of re-owning shadows, and he didn't give me one, but at least he did mention that it was a kind of a shadow hugging or projection situation. So at least I had it in my mind that was what was going on. I just didn't have the way. Thankfully, I got that later when I came across 3-2-1. I didn't have the means or the way to re-own that. But that's a really good example. I think a lot of people on the spiritual path can relate to that, the spiritual teacher one.
So another way shadow comes up, and I'll just mention this. Well, go ahead. You had a question, so go ahead.
No, go ahead. You're fine.
Well, we also can recognize our shadows by the fact that we see them in others. You know, so we'll say that it's a projected quality of shadow where, to use the example that I'm not greedy, but I look around and I see all the greed in other people, right? And so that's one way we can get a look at our shadows, is that we start to see that it's reflected in others, and it's something that disturbs and bothers us. You know, if we're a person that says, well, I see that person has greed or that person has avarice or whatever, but it doesn't work you up because, you know, everybody has traits that they're working with, and everybody has, in the human realm, has shortcomings and difficulties. But if it gets under your skin, and if you're bothered by it, and if it eats away at you, then it's pretty obvious that it probably has something to do with what you can't own in yourself. that's where that charge comes from.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, and that I heard that you and Craig were talking, Craig Hamilton, when he interviews you. I think that you said something along the lines is that, you know, we continue to discriminate and say certain things about situations, just the way that we judge situations and say, this person has this certain quality, this other person doesn't have the quality, I have this quality, but it doesn't have the same kind of charge to it. So what we're not saying is that thought is bad or judgment is necessarily bad.
Yeah, discriminations are 100 completely valid. People don't lose their qualities. It's that discomfort, that disequilibrium, that stirring up that happens to us when we see something in someone that's usually related to our shadow.
Right. So those were good. I thought those were good examples on both sides, the positive and negative that you gave, of just the one where you said avarice or greed. Is it true that you believe it could be any negative or positive trait, basically?
Any negative or positive trait that we're not able to hold in our first person awareness, that we're not able to identify as ours, whether it's negative or whether it's positive.
Okay.
And so you look at Michael Jackson and you think, oh my gosh, you know, one of the things I love about Michael Jackson is that Michael Jackson was such an extreme human being in both directions that he holds shadow. You can look at him and say, oh, he has such great talent, and you know, and then you don't see that you have a talent too. You haven't recognized what your own talent is. You know, maybe it's not singing and dancing. You know, maybe. You know, you're not designed to be a Motown star the way he was, but there's some talent you have that you're not seeing. And the reverse is also true. It could be, you know, that he had it, you know, there was kind of like a confusion around race, you know, for instance, or fame, you know, or sexuality. And then if you get very worked up about that quality in him, chances are you have something in yourself that isn't clarified.
That's a nice kind of object to use, not to objectify Michael Jackson, but because you're right, they're both extremes are there.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And yeah, not Michael Jackson the person, but Michael Jackson the icon or the figure.
Right.
You know, it's important to make a distinction between who Michael Jackson was as a person and, again, what we project onto that celebrity figure.
Right. Wonderful. So before we get into kind of the process and like spotting it and re-owning it, the one thing I think is important to talk about, and I'll just kind of share personally what happened for me, is that there was a strong recognition of the I am-ness of awareness as my real identity, in a sense, at least the unchanging aspect of my identity, and a real sense of all of the things that come along with that. But I think that the practices that I had been involved with or the teachings that I had been listening to really weren't addressing shadow issues. In other words, the main practice for me, although I did meditation and some inquiry, the main practice that I did was sort of like what I call living meditation, which was in each moment recognizing awareness and noticing appearances that come and go inseparably within awareness and kind of really finding that basic unmoving ground, noticing the moving and changing aspect of my experience, which was wonderful in one sense, really, really helpful. And in another sense, it actually didn't get to the shadows, and I didn't even know that they were shadows, and I didn't know what was bothering me.
Mm.
And even when I knew that something was bothering me about somebody else,
mm-hmm.
It's like I could sit and watch that reaction. But it just didn't do anything. It just continued to eat away at me persistently, repeatedly. And I wondered if you would speak to that, if you have a kind of a view about that in terms of some of our spiritual teachings, the ones that we cherish so much and that have been so valuable on so many different levels, aren't actually addressing this. Is that your sense?
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's not exactly their function to address it. You know, and I think that Ken is a great guide on this because he makes this point very clearly. In the same way that an Advaita practice like what you describe or Zen meditation, Shikantaza, is not really designed to help you, you know, develop your biceps, right?
Right.
It's not a practice of a relative nature. It's a practice of recognizing absolute nature, right? And
right.
So it would be like saying for me, it would be saying that when I sit in when I sit as the Buddha, or when I practice Shikantaza, you know, that I don't need to get my teeth filled, you know, like if I have a cavity. You know what I mean? Because the psychological patterns and the patterns on the relative, Ken would refer to it as the relative side of the street, which has to do with our past history, our memories, our emotional patterns, our, you know, all those things that are born of the relative qualities of our existence still, you know, still need to be addressed, you know. And the thing is that if you have a strong recognition of the basic ground of being, then your reactiveness is automatically, well, most generally lowered, so that you become much more able to work with, you know, the psychological and emotional aspects of your awareness and those things that are unconscious that are coming up and plaguing you in relationship and in your interactions in the world. Your fundamental recognition of your true nature will help you with that, but that alone is not sufficient to address them. They have to be addressed on the relative side of the street.
Exactly. Yeah, it's beautifully put, and it makes a lot of sense, actually. So Advaita and Zen and all these, they're doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing.
Precisely. They do exactly what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
But they don't do that. And, you know, keep in mind that psychology was an innovation of modernism, really. It's only been around for the last, I don't know, however many hundred, 150 years. So for us to expect now, keep in mind that the traditions have their way of working with shadow, but it has a different quality. You know, for instance, in conventional Christianity, we would talk about sin. You know, in conventional Buddhism, we would talk about ego. And in some ways, this is a different way of talking about, you know, shadow. But I think one of the things about shadow that's different, whereas sin, you tend to renounce or try to cut it out. With shadow, you actually try to bring it into awareness and to integrate it in a way that it's not influencing you. You actually try to own it and work with it, integrate it, as opposed to trying to get rid of it. That's a difference.
Right. That's no small point, which is a good segue. I think as we talk here, I think it'll become obvious what you mean by that, because that's a critical point that you just made. The difference between owning and the way that you just said it. So let's go into, is 3-2-1 process the process that you use, or the one that you, is that the main one that you use?
Yeah, the 3-2-1 process is one that was articulated by Ken and has basically been brought into practice by those of us at the Integral Institute. So he, through all of his, you know, understanding, he articulated it because Ken's big insight when he's been working generally is on these three different perspectives that we take naturally because we use language, the third person it, the second person you, and the first person I. And so he then saw that, you know, that comes up naturally in doing shadow work too, to see the shadow in third person as the it, as the he, as the she outside of ourselves, to bring it closer in as a you, and then finally to identify it as me. That's the 3-2-1, and that's Ken articulated it. Yeah.
Right. Good. So, do you mind if we take a more specific example, like maybe back to the greed, and let's just make up a scenario where there's someone, maybe use personal example, but I just thought maybe use a person who's experiencing maybe some symptom or something, and that it's really a greed kind of shadow, and how you might work with them through the 3-2-1 process.
Yeah, and the 3-2-1, one thing that I recommend when I teach the 3-2-1, and this is really for the people who are listening to this audio, is that it's really easy if you write it. You know, a good way to start working with it is to write it, because when you write it out, it really helps it become clear, and then once you get the technique down, then you can do it without writing it. Okay. Or you can sometimes work with a partner. So, Maybe are you willing to work on a shadow quality?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so do you want to maybe just pick something in your environment right now that maybe it's getting under your skin a little bit?
Sure. Controlling traits. So someone who wants to tell me, this is a common one that I've experienced all my life, actually. And actually, just before we start, once I began to recognize awareness more and more, it's almost like it began to get under my skin even more, because because there was this relaxation within me, and kind of everything is as it is. It's okay. So why are all these people out there
being so controlling?
Yeah.
Yeah, so let's start. We're going to start in third person, everybody who's listening. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Scott to describe, you know, this particular trait to me, this controlling trait. And you can think of a person, although we won't focus on ultimately on the person. We're focusing more on the trait. And just describe what it is they do and how they act and why it bothers you so much. So this is a third person description of this trait. So go ahead.
A third, just of the trait itself, or the with the person.
So what you can talk about the person, and we'll just get more clear what the trait is as you go along.
Okay, so the person tells me the way that I should live my life, that I should be more responsible, that I should see things the way that he sees things. In other words, his habits and mannerisms should be my habits and mannerisms, and constantly kind of nagging me and saying, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing this? And it feels like an intrusion. It feels like, leave me alone.
Yeah, okay. Okay, got it. Okay, so that would be the third person is really describing that. Now what's going to happen is I'm going to be that controlling person, okay? So we're going to move into second person now. We're going to have a dialogue. We say that by talking to the trait, sometimes you can kind of start to see it a little bit more clearly. So I'm going to be that controlling trait, and your job is going to be to just ask questions of me, okay?
Okay.
So I'm going to give you the opportunity to bring the trait somewhat closer to you.
Yeah. Okay, so first of all, why don't you just basically leave me alone?
Well, because I'm controlling. And since I'm controlling, I'm not going to do what you want. I'm going to tell you what to do.
Okay. Don't you see that I'm over here?
My job is to try to control you.
Right. Don't you see that this is my life, and basically, I only know how to live my life. You can't tell me how to live my life.
Well, I can tell you, actually. So, I can say to you, this is what I think you should do. You know, I think right now that it's important for you to explore this thing about being controlling, and you may not like that about me, but interestingly enough, you're kind of telling me what to do, if you'll notice.
Well, but don't you see that I've done a lot of spiritual work, and so therefore I'm not controlling you, really, because I've relinquished control, and I'm at one with what is, so I think it's really your problem, not mine.
Okay, so can you see, though, that you're telling me how to be?
Yes.
Okay, so isn't it true then that you're actually trying to control me also?
Yes. Of course.
Okay, so this is the funny part, right?
It is funny, yeah.
Okay, so now I want you to, now we're going to move into first person where you just own, okay, I'm controlling too. Like I look around and I see all kinds of ways I want people to be different. See if you can find that part of yourself.
Okay. And list examples?
Yeah, just like, so now for the listener again, we described this controlling in third, and then in second, I was the controlling voice, and you talked to me, Scott. Now Scott's going to actually own it and say, I am controlling, and then just notice what you can about that for yourself. See if you can find it.
Yeah. I'm controlling because I would like everyone around me to be more present, to be more at home with what's going on, and if they would do that, it would be better off for everybody and for
exactly.
me.
Exactly. So one of the paradoxes of being spiritually awake is you want everyone else to be like you, which isn't very awake.
Right.
It's hilarious, isn't it?
Yes. Well, you can see why we don't want to own this stuff. I mean, it's...
Oh.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah.
Now, again, like, does that mean that when you are dealing with people that they're not being controlling of you? No, it just means that you know you can be the same way.
Right.
Right? So it frees up your energy. You're not quite as judgmental. You may be a little more compassionate. And you're able to just say to them, I understand you want me to change because I always want you to change too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm probably not going to any more than you're going to.
Right. But we both want that anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But you can feel how when you recognize that on both sides there's more compassion.
Oh, absolutely. And humility.
Yeah. And humility, absolutely. Lots of humility.
Yeah. Okay. And also freedom, because when I do this stuff on my own and really kind of own it, it's like, even though it's painful at first, there's just a sense of like, almost like years of doing that releases for a second there. It's just like, oh, it's okay. It's okay. You're the same thing that you're at war with. You are that same trait. And it's just like,
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly it. And so then you just go, okay, well, he's trying to control me and I wish he wouldn't, and that's my control, and you know, it's just what it is.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah, I think there's nothing like really making it a specific, it almost has to be, it's almost like you can't talk about this stuff too much in the abstract. You really, to do the dirty work, you have to roll your sleeves up and say, well, what's really bugging me, like personally?
Yeah. Yeah, you totally have to. You totally have to. And I always tell people that what happens is it releases some energy. I mean, when I've worked with people on this kind of shadow work, it's amazing. They start crying. They start laughing. You know, you automatically started laughing. I don't know if you noticed.
Yeah.
You started laughing. And it's just like it just releases energy. Ken makes the point that we tie up energy, keeping things out of our awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So when we let it come into our awareness, it's helpful. And we generally get just a little bit more compassionate. And as you and I have already said, it doesn't mean that you give up the discriminations. You're just not wrapped up by them. You're like, oh, yeah, there they are trying to control me again. Whatever. You know?
Right, right. No, absolutely, yeah.
No, it's not a source of such angst.
You know, that's a small point right there that's important, is that it's that we don't give up discrimination. And I think there's a kind of a prevailing view that if we can just get rid of all thought, we'll all be okay. And first of all, it's not practical or realistic, and it's not very healthy.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And that's why I really actually love the integral model, because it's a model of transcend and include. So it isn't that we give up thought, it's that we create a tremendous amount of space so that our thoughts and our discriminations can take their rightful place. It's,
right.
You know, they're always going to be there. And there's always going to be some traces of ego that are at work, and some self-striving, and some, we're always going to be manifesting some, because sometimes our greatest gifts are precisely our shadow. And we have to become aware of that, you know, that the very things, for instance, you know, for me, people might say to me, oh, you're such a great teacher, and you stand in front of the room, and it's so easy to listen to you, and, you know, you're so charismatic. And that's all great, except that sometimes when I come into the room, people would wish I would disappear. You know, they don't always want me to be in that. But there's, you know, you see what I mean? So even the traits that we have sometimes have shadow qualities.
Sure.
You know, you might be a great athlete, for instance. But in order to become that great athlete, you actually had to be focused on very little else. You know, so there's a shadow to that very experience.
Absolutely, yes. So one thing I wanted to talk about, Ken talked a little, and this was a topic that I struggled with a little bit when he would talk about certain, I think he gave the example of someone who says, I just have these horrible headaches. I have these physical symptoms playing on me. And then the way he would work it through was to help someone show, not that every physical symptom is because of a shadow, he's not saying that, but he says sometimes the way that he explains it, sometimes this appears as like a third person, or a symptom, an it, that's not even personalized.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, it's less my expertise because I don't work with that kind of somatic and bodily awareness, but the Jungians that I know who do, like for instance Arnold Mendel, for anybody who's listening who's familiar with his work, he's really very good at this, the way in which sometimes body symptoms are actually, there's this kind of similar 3-2-1 quality where the body's actually doing us a service by taking a particular quality of distress and manifesting it so that we don't have to hold it in our awareness. So, for instance, you know, a classic example might be that we have a pain in our neck, you know, because the person we're working with is really driving us crazy and we're not acknowledging it. So it shows us as a pain in the neck.
Right.
Something like that.
I could see when a situation like that, writing would be helpful at first, because the connection might not be made between this physical pain and something in my environment with respect to relationship or something.
Well, the beautiful thing is that our minds are, I mean, this is what psychology has taught us, is just how radically creative. our body mind is. It's like it just does all kinds of miraculous things that when you get really close to it and start looking at it, have really deep and significant meaning.
Yeah, it's quite amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Before we go, a couple other things I wanted to talk about with you, and it's been great so far, and I think everyone listening they're interested in this topic and really enjoy this. I think I'm getting a lot out of it. But I wanted to talk because a lot of the people in our audience just listening to this audio are going to be people who are spiritual seekers or people who have an interest in non-dual realization, maybe integral, who knows what tradition. Can you speak to some of them? And I think I can speak to a couple of them too. It's just shadows that kind of just happen for a lot of people on the spiritual search. And I'll give you one example is that when we start to get a taste of what it's like when our ego doesn't dominate our experience so much, mm-hmm. not that we lose the ego completely, but when we just get a sense that we're not identifying as much, I noticed in my own life that a little story, there became almost like a denial of self rather than transcending or seeing through self. It was almost like any of those qualities that were self kind of pushed away, and then all of a sudden there were other people who were ego. And it started to be, it felt like, oh, he's lost an ego, she's lost an ego. And I saw that pop up, and I thankfully had gotten a hold of the 3-2-1 process by then and could re-own that a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And with experiencing the humility and the freedom and the love from that. Is that one that you've come across with people? And what are some of the other kind of spiritual shadows that if you'll name a couple that you've come across working with people? Spiritual meaning based on insights and things that we come across, you know, on the path.
Yeah, well, I think you've pointed out a couple already. So there's an interesting thing where it's very interesting when we start to have this experience of, you might say, a just expanded awareness in which the self-striving is not at the center of our experience, is how you expressed it. You know, that then somehow, you know, how is it that suddenly we find ourselves judging other people? So this quality of judgment that comes up is very classic kind of spiritual shadow. Another word for it that comes up is piety. You know, so it's one of the things that I say often about doing shadow work is it keeps you from becoming pious, right? Because
right.
You do a lot of spiritual practice and you get very proud of yourself, mm-hmm. you know, and then pretty soon you've got a kind of spiritual pride about you, you know, or even, which can even become a kind of arrogance. And so, you know, inevitably that in a certain way the shadow is really beautiful, because I've always said that one thing I like about shadow is the vehicle of development. So every time, you know, an ego will tend to appropriate your spiritual experience. So if you read in the Zen tradition, for instance, it's quite common to read about a master who had just a great enlightened experience, and the next thing they notice is that they're proud of how big their enlightenment was. And like that happens at like almost simultaneously, right?
Yeah.
That the self just kind of starts to appropriate our experience. So I think that's a really good shadow. Another one might be that you become so kind of neutral that you just simply don't have feelings.
Yeah.
You know, so things, you know, it's very hard to have a relationship with someone who's done a lot of spiritual practice because they won't engage you in a simple, ordinary kind of human conversation about something that you're upset about because they just don't have feelings. They just can't relate to it. Another shadow that comes up is that this one expressed in communities I've worked with where people get really deep in kind of oneness or unitive consciousness and you can't get them to participate in the direction of the group, you know,
right.
So they kind of lose a sense of purpose or of belonging, like now that's really necessary, and yet the other people in the community are having to pick up the responsibility for running the organization. So those are a few that just pop into my mind as we're talking.
No, that's good. I think it's good for people just to hear that and maybe recognize that in themselves. And it is true that with these great big spiritual insights that we have, that there's a shadow side or a curse side that kind of haunts us. And sometimes it's like we're blind to it. We just don't see it. And yet other people see it, or it's manifesting in our relationships anyway, whether we see it or not. And it can even get to really extreme, like arrogant, mean aspects, you know.
Yeah.
At the, yeah.
Yep.
Another one I just wanted to add, another one that happened for me and that I see that's pretty prevalent is the word intellectual is thought to be a bad thing in spiritual practices. You know, the whole, it's like this little weapon that people shoot at each other. I've noticed, like, that teaching or that teacher or that is too intellectual or
I think that looks funny.
Yeah.
Like, well, saying that thing has a body.
Yeah, right.
What are you kidding?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I have to say that I've had that, because there was a saying that sort of the transparency of thought, in a way, and that, you know, you can no longer really rely on your beliefs in the way that you used to, and that
right.
There's no longer as much identification. There's an ability to take other viewpoints. All that stuff is good and healthy, but somewhere along the way, I think the story, for me even, there was like a period of time where my mind went relatively quiet. And again, that little ego kind of tried to make sense of that and says, oh, that just means intellect is bad. And if I engage intellect, if I engage the world again in that way, somehow I'm going to get completely lost in ego again, mm-hmm. which isn't actually, because mm-hmm. like you said earlier, once you have that recognition of awareness, you really have the foundation to allow that intellect to arise again freely. Yeah.
And we call that freely functioning. You know, it's important to actually... So here we're talking about development, and we're talking about the path is that when you're identified with your thoughts as you, there's a lot of suffering and pain that comes from that. Then through practice, we disidentify with our thoughts. We start to see that they're empty. In other words, there's no deep substance to our thoughts. They're fleeting. Our thoughts are changeable. We think in opposites all the time.
Right.
And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of self-orientation in our thinking. So then we do meditation practice, and we disidentify with our thoughts. We relinquish our thoughts. We let them go. And we start to settle into a deeper quality of being, a more spacious quality of being, a quality where we feel more relaxed. We're more at home. We're not dividing the world up with our preferences and with our notions of this and that and right and wrong and good and bad and high and low and all the things that attend the thinking mind, all these comparisons, which creates, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, creates a tremendous amount of suffering. So we do that, and then the point is not then to not think. The point is to actually use the tool of the intellect as a tool, and as Ram Dass likes to say, the intellect is a wonderful tool. It's a terrible master.
Yeah, right.
Right? So, again, yeah. It's true. Through your meditative, through your awakening, you see the places in which thought arises, in which it's appropriate, but you're not over-identified, nor do you let it rule your world, because right. thought is way too limited a function. We have an instinctive function, we have an emotional function, we have a meditative space awareness, and that we need to be whole human beings.
Right. Yeah, that's beautiful. I mean, that's really wonderful. I think, again, that's something that people listening to will some will take a deep sigh of relief to hear that, you know, because I think there's just people out there who were like me, didn't really understand why was I reacting so strongly to this whole intellectual thing. I told Ken that the first time I picked up his book Integral Theory, I read 5 pages and I shut it,
mm-hmm.
because I was right there in that place where, to me, spirituality equated with no thought and clear open space of pure awareness, and so you can see that's not that long ago. But then just looking out into the world and the way that I was thinking about things and seeing, well, I really do have this kind of anti-intellectual slant to me, and I wanted to find out more about that. And then by reading Integral Theory, I was able to see what it was that was happening. So
and we can still, you know, we still have the experiences. Sometimes we'll just get too caught up in our thoughts and get too caught up in our discursive thinking. And, you know, people who haven't had a deep awakening experience or don't have a, you know, a profound meditative discipline, you can see that they mistake thought for reality quite a lot.
Yeah.
Because what we think and what's true and what's real are not even close to the same. And the whole purpose of our practice is to help us release our thinking so that we actually can... Interestingly, I'll interrupt myself and just say something, that concepts, language have functions, which, if you'll remember the old story about Helen Keller, when her experience of being blind, deaf, and mute, her experience was that the world was one kind of undifferentiated pole, and that when she first learned the word water, and when her teacher put her hand in the water, that literally in that one instant, the entire multiplicity of the world, all the various things came into being. So she all of a sudden, that one concept opened her awareness to the multiplicity of existence.
Wow.
So concepts and Ken's map opens us to existence, as well as can interfere with our experience. And I think he's done a beautiful job, and he's very rigorous on this point. What he's providing is a map. It's not the territory, and a good map can help us see reality more clearly, in the same way the word water helped her to see reality more clearly. But if you mistake that word for the actual water, then there's a problem. And
right.
That's what we mean when we say that people are overly intellectual. And I think in a way it's a healthy response, but people need to outgrow it, because we were all schooled in academic settings in which no one told us not to mistake our thinking for reality.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So then all of a sudden you realize, oh my God, it's not reality, and then you get stuck in that position.
Right,
Being able to see how it works and how it fits. All spiritual teachings are concepts. All language is concepts. We'd all be going around in silence all the time.
Right, and of course, you know, I always tell people the concept that they're all concepts is concepts too, or is a concept too, and so you can't really land on that one either. So
no.
Yeah. And the one thing that I, the feeling that I get energetically from shadow work is a welcoming of all of the different voices, the different polarities and the opposites that we've been talking about, and kind of welcoming them, all of them back in a way that so that enlightenment doesn't feel like an empty space. It feels like that empty space is just the ground, but it's moving, and there's an inclusion of all of these voices and energies and things that I thought I didn't like about myself. Well, that's also me, and the things I didn't like about the things I was trying to repress and put up over there to say that, you know, and it becomes this really love affair with life, in a sense that it's really dynamic and alive, and it's not, it doesn't have to be just cold and detached at all.
Not in the least, not in the least. And from the largest realization, you are all of existence anyway. So
right.
Everything there isn't anything in the entire phenomenal world that isn't you.
Right.
Even the things that we don't want to be there.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So, Diane, one more thing. I wanted to, of course, if something else arises, we'll talk about it before we get off here, because another thing that I got from the 3-2-1 process is something that Ken, I think, calls external pressures, internal drive, and this was one of those aha moments too, because the example that I gave, there are many personal examples that I have, just with my partner, because of the intimacy of that relationship and the way that people often play with each other in relationship in terms of pressuring each other to be different, change, But so the external pressure, internal drive thing is that when someone is pressuring me to do something, and I say it could be taking out the trash, which is an example in my life, or being more responsible, it always, for a long time, it just felt like this person that was nagging me, and I had no desire to do this thing, whatever they were telling me to do, to be more responsible, to whatever the thing was. It's like it just felt like completely outside pressure. Like, why won't they leave me alone?
Mm-hmm.
Until I kind of re-owned that through Ken's process and kind of to find out, well, I have a drive to actually do what this person is asking me or thinks that I should do. And that was another way where something was released, so that just a conflict that was created in that situation released itself.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. That's lovely.
Yeah.
And there may be two drives, because one drive may be to do what the person's asking you to, and the other drive may be to create a really harmonious relationship in which you take shared responsibility. So you may also have a drive to make that person happy.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's helpful for people to hear, too, who have never just heard that before. The example that I give is like, one thing I tell people is when you feel yourself getting defensive, when someone's pressuring you, when you feel that defense has so much wisdom in it, if if you just listen to what it's trying to tell you this is a drive or a story that you have that you're not really owning. And the example that I give is that if someone pressured you to put on a tutu and fly to the moon, you're not going to get defensive about that because you probably never had that drive before.
Yeah, that's
good. So absurd, you know. But if they said to you something that's very personal to your story, like, you should paint the house. You said you were going to paint the house last spring, and you may get defensive about if there's a kind of an internal drive that you've repressed. And that defensiveness is telling us everything if we'll just listen to it.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Was there anything else that you wanted to add to anything that we've said?
No, the only thing I would do is just praise you for being such a natural seeker and such a energized learner, and that you're, you know, also willing to take your learning and share it with other people, I think is really awesome.
Yeah.
So just a little praise going your way.
Well, and I've enjoyed this conversation a lot. You've brought a lot of insight, and it's such a pleasure for me to put this out for people, just so that they can, for anyone who's interested, to listen to. And just want to thank you very much for having the conversation. I hope we can stay in touch.
All right. Yeah, me too, Scott. Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay, well, take care, Diane.
You too. Bye, everybody.